Yeah, my name is Niklas Nielsen. I'm a doctor in Sweden, working in Helsingborg Hospital and practicing academics in Lund University.
Perfect. And what brought you to the attention of everyone in the entire social media world is you're the lead author of the TTM trial.
Now, you might be asking yourself, what did I just jump into? Well, this is Scott Weingart. This is the MCRIT podcast, and you are hearing from, that's right, Niklas Nielsen, lead author of the TTM trial. I've wanted to have him on the podcast since the trial was published. Our time schedules just kept missing each other, and he was coming to New York for the Neurocritical Care Conference I had mentioned on earlier podcasts, and I said, let me sit down with him in person, which is much more fun, and talk to him about the TTM trial, and that's what you're about to hear. Now, I'm just going to apologize up front. The audio is not up to the pristine standards of the MCRIT podcast, or at least what I hope to make the standards, and that is because we're just in a cafe, we're drinking coffee, not beer, so it's not as much fun, and we're talking amidst the crowd noise. So it's perfectly listenable, but it is not pristine audio, but the information imparted is incredible, so hopefully you will look beyond the lack of clarity in sound and just rely on the clarity of information. Let's get to the interview.
We spent an enormous amount of time looking at the trial, talking about it in the critical care and resuscitation social media world. So I'm not going to bore you with questions about the basics, because if people haven't heard about it, if they haven't read the trial, they don't deserve to be listening to this in the first place. So I want to delve into the nitty-gritty. The first question I'm going to ask you is, just in case a hurricane hit now, I want to make sure I get it out because it's the most important one to me, is aside from everything TTM did, you established a prognostic protocol that we've adopted, and I think many centers have said, finally, there's something in the literature we could use until something better comes along.
Yeah.
And that protocol was asking around the 72-hour mark after rewarming.
Yeah, 72 hours. That's a misconception from many that they say 72 hours after cardiac arrest, but we actually stated 72 hours after rewarming. So like 4 to 4.5, 5 days after the arrest.
Absolutely. Now my question to you is, and I gosh, do I hope you guys have the data to answer this. Right now we have, I think, a very good protocol that was used in both the 36 group and the 33 group.
Yeah.
But if you guys looked at these patients in the 36 group at the 72 hour from arrest mark, we'd have a comparator to be able to say, is that enough to prognosticate? The best evidence, I think.
Yeah, actually, that will be in the European guidelines that will come out. I don't have the total details because it's Tobias Kronberg, our neurologist, that has done all the intense analysis of all this. But what I've heard from him, there will be a 72-hour as the earliest mark that will be applicable for both 33 and 36, actually, because the sensitivity for the prognostic markers is not that great at that hour, so you have uncertainty for quite a number of patients still, and for them you should wait, but already at 72 hours from cardiac arrest it's possible to make a prognosis for the grave cases.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And do you know when that literature is going to be published?
I think it will be out in the fall, and all respect for Tobias, Claudio Sandroni, and the others that did the job. I'm not in that group, so I might have missed something.
But I'm super excited that that will be published.
We really have looked into all the prognostic data from the TTM trial, and we have a lot, and we will have more as analysis come through, especially all the biomarkers and also the EEGs. Yeah.
So for these next questions, the next two questions actually, you're going to hear me refer to Case Polderman, one of the most prominent researchers in hypothermia. And Case had two questions he wanted me to ask Niklas, and they are the next two questions you're going to hear. Case also published a editorial in Critical Care I'll link to in the show notes, worth a read, and supposedly very soon you will see Dr. Nielsen's reply to that editorial, and it's worth reading both of those. Okay, let's get back to the questions.
So the rewarming speed that was chosen. This is a big issue. Both Case and I, we both use a quarter of a degree an hour as our rewarming speed. The TTM trial used 0.5.
Yeah, we said maximum of 0.5. That's different from 0.5. So we didn't mandate 0.5, but we said maximum 0.5. And the speed was actually 0.36. And it was, if you compare it to the HOCA trial, which is the only randomized trial that has the data, we are exactly on the same slope. So I'm not that worried about the rewarming speed. There is no real good data. The best we have is observational data from Holland, where they didn't find a difference between faster or slower rewarming. So I think to say that the rewarming rate of the T3M trial would explain the no difference between 33 and 36, that's probably not true.
I agree with you. All right, let's get Case's second question out of the way. So Case was concerned about the screening, and he looked at the numbers of patients that were actually enrolled, and he said it's very small from what he would expect from the other previous publications and his expectations from the centers involved. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The inclusion period for the total trial was a little bit more than 2 years. But of course, as in every trial, there is a washing period. And if you do like his, just divide numbers of months with sites, that doesn't give the real picture. The median inclusion per site was 21 patients. And for the sites that that included above the median, they included 80% of the patients in the trial. So quite a number of sites had very few patients. They were there to get a generalizable result, but the large sites really did the bulk of the patients. And some of the sites, they didn't come along until it was 1 year left, and they recruited with a high speed. So I would say that it reflects very much our expectations. We stopped or finished the trial exactly on the date that we had in our wildest fantasies, actually. So yeah, so the recruitment, and then also KIS is sitting on a site, as you are, with a very high enrollment rate. That's not really what we have in Europe. We have some large sites, but we also have quite a few sites that admit on a lower rate.
Well, that speaks to my next question, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Both of us, I think, if this happened to us, would want to be at a high-volume center.
Yeah.
Should low-volume centers be doing this? And if they should, is 36 a better temperature because it's easier for them to manage?
Yeah, that might be a good... I think the trend is that we're moving to cardiac rest centers and trying to focus to sites where they have 24/7 cath. But the infrastructure is very different in different parts of the world, so... And 36 is definitely easier to perform. You don't have to be afraid of infections and electrolyte disorders and arrhythmias. So for sites, if you choose between 33 and 36, and if you're in a site with a little bit less experience, 36 is a much better temperature. But as we can say from the subgroup data, it's the same for the large sites, no difference.
So one of the differences that was in the subgroups that was of particular interest to me and was, I think for me, the main impetus to switch my hospital over was the variance between the hemodynamics, with 36 having much better hemodynamic stability.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that and why you think that is?
Yeah, we were a little bit astonished because we thought before the trial, or starting the trial, that the 33 group would come better out in terms of cardiovascular stability. But it seemed to be exactly the opposite. The subgroup that came in to the hospital with circulatory shock, they fared much worse, in especially the first days. So we had increased mortality in the group treated with 33 if they were admitted with the circulatory, not cardiogenic. That's an important point, the circulatory shock.
What did you folks do for the patients who came in post-ROSC but didn't meet the criteria for TTM? Were you still cooling those patients?
Yeah, absolutely. All the sites in the TTM trial were experienced hypothermia centers, so they used the standard protocol for the patients that were not enrolled. So in our unit, we cooled to 33 the patients with the asphyctic cardiac arrest and cardiac arrest in hospital, for instance, as we did before the trial.
Did you have a cutoff either during or before the trial of patients that you just said their prognosis is so dim, we're not going to cool this patient?
Yeah, based on our registry data, we were very reluctant even to take the patients with unwitnessed asystole to the unit, especially if they were old or had comorbidities. The only cases where we have a good prognosis is the very young patients with an unwitnessed asystole, where you should definitely continue full active care. But in the general case, that's the group we did not admit or cool.
Some people look at this trial and say, now we don't need to use these complicated machines. We don't need to have tight control. We could just let happen what happened. And it drives me nuts. I'd love to hear your take on that.
Yeah, that's definitely not true. Because in the TTM trial, we had meticulous attention to temperature in both groups. And we chose 36 just to be sure that we avoided fever, even in the control group, so to say. So it was tight control, even tighter in the 36 group than in the 33 group. We also paid a lot of attention to every other detail in post-resuscitation care in both groups. So they were treated with the high attention, and that's very, very important to realize.
Now, did you find the shivering was greater in the 36 group?
Yeah, it was a little bit more in terms of percentage, absolute percentages, but there was no statistically significant difference. And our experience from the units where I work is that 36 is not shivering more than 33. That's not my feeling.
Yeah. Now, I spoke to Stephen Bernard, and his switch to 36 was, I think, the best proclamation, the time has come. And that took an immense amount of intellectual integrity, I think, to have one of the original 33 proponents switch over. But Stephen still maintains that patients who had intra-arrest cooling, he's still going to keep at 33 for their 24-hour duration. What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting subject, a very interesting issue. And there are ongoing trials on the intra-arrest cooling. And that might make sense. And I think for those sites that are involved in those trials, they should absolutely continue with the cool temperature. Otherwise, they will just disrupt their trials. I would not change to a 36 arm in those trials. And I don't know how far they are in the recruitment rate, but that will be highly interesting to see, because that might, again, change the paradigm for how we treat these patients.
Let's talk about your particular feelings on post-arrest management, whether it be in the TTM trial or your own feelings in your own unit. Do you have a MAP goal you push these guys to?
Yeah. I know that we are always a little bit lower in Europe compared to the United States, but we have 65 as our lowest mean arterial pressure in our unit.
Now, in Australia and in my own shop, we push to 80.
Yeah.
Without great data to support it, admittedly. I mean, mostly animal extrapolation. Is there anyone in your unit who is pushing these guys a little harder?
Yeah, I think there are sites doing that. But we looked at the data and we could see that the cutoff is somewhere around 60. So I think 65, 70 is a good.
Is everyone getting taken to the cath lab unless they have another obvious cause of their arrest?
In our unit and most units around my in my area, and I know quite a few in the trial, they use the standard ST elevation infarction, new left bundle branch block. But we are tending to get more liberal to, if it's not an obvious non-cardiac cause, then you probably should take the patient to the cath lab. So we have the usual signs, then hemodynamic instability also.
I'd love to hear where you think, first off, hypothermia fits into a patient who had ECMO placed, whether it be intra-arrest or with profound circulatory collapse post-arrest. Are they going to get 36 or 33?
That's a very difficult question. I think it should be answered by a good trial. I know these hyper-intense protocols that are pushed from around the world. There are quite a few ongoing small pilot trials. That will be interesting. It's very labor intensive, and I had no good answer to that question, actually. It might be that since we showed, or had signals at least indicating better stability at 36, that might be the better temperature for ECMO patients.
Sure, but that's balanced with the fact that since most of the VA ECMO is not providing full support, that lowering the metabolic needs may also be advantageous.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. We don't have a great answer.
No. And it's, yeah.
What's your take on ventilator management post-arrest?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I try to stay normal. I think it's too little data to support any other regime than going for normal. I tend to go a little bit on the upper side of normal in the carbon dioxide, since we use alpha-stat. So I try to be between 5 and 6.
That's a PaCO2 of 37.5 to 45 millimeters per mercury for our American listeners.
I know there are ongoing trials from Australia and New Zealand where they push hypercapnia as a protective measure, but that's still very speculative, I would say.
Low tidal volume?
Low tidal volume, yeah. We use that for, that's our basic ICU protocol.
And do you have any resuscitation marker goals? Are you using lactate? Are you using central venous or mixed venous oxygens to monitor whether these patients are adequately perfusing, or do you just use Gestalt?
Yeah, we used to use quite a lot of measures. We're getting a little more basic as time goes by. I think lactate is a good marker just to see that you're going in the right direction, and that was actually something that was clearing faster in the 36 groups compared to the 33 group, as you will see from publications coming out. But in my unit, we use a lot of echo to just get a visual picture.
So what do you think the next innovation in intra or post-arrest management is going to be? What are we going to see in the coming years?
I think that's very difficult to answer, but I think that where we might be able to do most good is for the patients that leave the hospitals, actually. I think we're, at least in Europe, we just leave them like left in the air. If a patient leaves the hospital with a stroke, for instance, they have a rehabilitation program and they get all kinds of attention. But the cardiac arrest patients, if they're walking and talking, they're just left with no follow-up. And I think that might be the easiest or most cost-beneficial intervention to do to deal with that part of the... Because I think if you do a good job in the ICU, I do not see a magic bullet coming through in the months or years to come. I think we can improve a little bit, but maybe not intensely. If you pay attention to the patient, then they will have a quite good outcome, but they have problems when they leave the hospital. I think we should focus there.
This has been fantastic. I'm so glad we got to do this.
And
it's much nicer to do it in person than over the phone. Yeah.